Every success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, Bruce Kent. And if you've got any views about what might possibly accelerate the rather tardy arrival of world peace, you can share them with me, Colin Bell, Radio Scotland, Queen Margaret Drive, Glasgow, G12 8DG. What with the prospect of land reform and the removal of hereditary peers' voting rights in the Lords, things aren't looking too bright for the aristocracy. And high time too, you may think, wondering only why there's no place in the scenario for a tumbril or two. But possibly there is some sort of case for keeping a duke about the place, if only for the heritage industry and the tourist trade. Well, let's see. In London now is writer Richard D. North, and here in Glasgow, human ecologist Alistair McIntosh, and Maxwell MacLeod, who's happier keeping his title a secret. Well, Alistair, the scaffold or the showcase?
Well, the scaffold would be slightly unethical, but also problematical, because unless our new Scots Parliament is going to do something about the laws of succession that allow the rich to concentrate wealth, often at the cost of disinheriting wives and siblings, then the scaffold is only going to give us more of the same in their ears. As for the showcase, we already have quite enough of promoting big houses, landed properties, as being our heritage, using public funds to maintain these things, whereas in fact they're not. They have usurped our heritage.
Yes, I never pointed out where did they get the money to build them and who did the building anyway, and it certainly wasn't them themselves. Give you that. Richard, do I detect what I hear that you may have a certain sympathy, nostalgia for the aristocracy?
Oh, it's not a nostalgia. I mean, I'm very irritated that Labour should think of getting rid of, say, the voting rights of the peers and the lords. I mean, list it for a start. It's their house. Secondly, the heredity is obviously the principle by which we all live our lives. We all try and do well but for our children. And thirdly, of course, the aristocracy in the House of Lords is hugely valuable in reminding us of our history, good and bad. I mean, these are the people who are descended from the good and bad of our history. But more than that, they're the only people in society who are so connected historically, so that they're rooted in time. We know where they've been, we know what they've done, and they're rooted in place. When an aristocrat speaks of his county, he speaks of a place where, yes, you know that person is strongly identified with that county in a way that the rest of us, for good or ill, simply aren't. So I like their rootedness, I like their connectedness, and they remind us, of course it's not all virtuous, and of course in some sense their wealth was built on us. And that produces also a community of interest, oddly. I mean, any sensible aristocrat knows perfectly well that it's not through his personal merit that he has a privilege. Society isn't like that.
Yes, well, I suppose what you say about when they speak of their county, in some cases, like the Duke of Buccleuch, he does it with perfect accuracy. He owns most of it.
Very good idea, too.
Well, yes, I don't mind. I'm entirely sure I'm with you there, but let me try to find Maxwell instead.
I don't invite you to be with you. I invite you merely to consider the argument that a good landlord, a good estate, is for the people on it, probably a pretty agreeable way of going on. Now, it is true that we are neither producing aristocrats with quite the old interest, nor are we producing, as it were, the tenant type. People want, people for some reason aren't good at deference anymore and think it taints them right. To live. Hold on. To live in that relationship.
You have rather a long innings here without Maxwell getting a word in.
Okay, go on.
Maxwell, it seems to me that what we know is we bemoan not only the occasional absence of noblesse oblige, but this distinctly uppity nature among the peasantry.
Well, we didn't have much deference from the south of England there, did we? You rather put me on the spot here. I now have to confess in a rather pompous fashion. The problem, the reason you've asked me here, is because I am Sir Maxwell MacLeod of Fury, which is I'm a baronet, which is really rather an inconsequential title. The baronet is, of course, just the kind of Ford Fiesta of the business. I suppose it's BBC cuts that you couldn't get anything more significant. But I am acutely embarrassed about being Sir Maxwell MacLeod. But I must say I'm rather proud of the fact that I'm of Funery, because it is associated with generations of ministers from Funery, and I'm very proud of that background. So I rather would go with Richard that the notion that there's a certain colour in being associated with a place and with events in the past. I spoke the other day to my good friend Clanranald MacDonald, who is the captain of Clanranald, who claims to be the direct descendant from Somerled. And he said that he saw him as being the himself as being the marker of Somerled in the 20th century, which I thought was pompous nonsense at first. But when I thought about it, I thought it's rather colourful that we have somebody here who is representing this extraordinary figure in history, and Clanranald is currently building galleys and stuff like that. So I rather enjoy that colour, but it's pretty inconsequential.
But it's that more. For every single example that you will adduce of that, for somebody who has achieved it by merit, has felt this sense of service and duty and obligation, one will then turn around and say, yes, and how many of them are there because their great-great-grandmothers slept with kings? And how many of them are there because their great-great-grandfathers plundered third world countries?
Oh, I would certainly accept that, but I would say that in my case, neither is the case. And I think that if I had inherited a title which was based on something as dastardly as that, I wouldn't be proud of it, but I am proud of being associated with a collection of rather radical ministers.
Well, Alistair, you heard also Richard's spirited defence of the right of the hereditary peers to vote. Except, of course, they represent both good and bad, in which case I suppose we say that most of the population in Australia ought to be able to vote on the issues of governance here, because most of them were bad and were sent there for that.
Yeah, but, I mean, wait a minute. How do these characters vote? 483 of the peers take the Conservative whip, against only 126 taking the Labour whip. There's a massive Tory majority built into the House of Lords. Now, I thought we lived in an Well, we do live in an aristocracy. Mm-hmm. I thought we lived in a democracy, not an aristocracy, an oligarchy. And as for this business of rootedness in the land, what about the 500,000 people pushed off the land during the Highland clearances and elsewhere in Scotland? What about their rootedness? Are there not others of us who have a sense of our history, our heritage, and it is not one of class landed power?
But the way the Tories vote, the way the House of Lords works, the fact of the matter is, I actually agree that it's fitted to have an inbuilt Tory majority, but even if you got it, the facts of the way it's worked was that it was as irritating to Thatcher as it has been to Blair. Of course they're reactionary, that's the point of the House of Lords. They're going to have very great difficulty when they've got a politically correct House of Lords that is totally on the side of whatever opinion polls say. That's what the Commons is there for. The Lords, insofar as it is useful as an irritant to the politically correct. So, I don't mind people trying to reform the darn thing, but they're not going to succeed in making it a better, do better, the job that it's designed to do. And as to their being bad, half the aristocracy being bad or naughty, that's rather the point. They represent the world as it has been in these islands. They're not given power, they are given a small voice, the right to speak, and oddly enough, however irrational and peculiar, actually that adds to their glamour and charm and interest, they are capable of speaking about the way things are, have been, and the as it were, the tradition from which we now choose to move when we seek reform.
Aaron, nonsense. You're not seriously saying we can't organise a better second chamber than the current system. I mean, you say it's an irritant to the politically correct, which is an extraordinary concept, but I think we all here would support the notion of a second chamber, but organised through this hereditary principle, that is an utter anachronism and absurdity.
Of course it's an anachronism. It's a delicious anachronism, and when you replace it with something rational, the trouble is, of course, that it will have legitimacy, and when it has legitimacy, the House of Lords will say, I'm sorry to the House of Commons, we've got legitimacy too. At the moment, it's a great advantage that subtly the House of Lords can never say we should overrule you because we have legitimacy. They know they haven't legitimacy, which makes them speak on matters of interest, and we are all aware that all they are is an interesting voice. That's the whole point of them.
You haven't addressed my point. Are you seriously suggesting that this is the best way of organising a second chamber? My father was a member of the House of Lords, and I met dozens and dozens of Lords, hereditary and appointed by various prime ministers, and I never met a single one who didn't think that the House of Lords needed radical reform. Well, the only two people I think I've ever met in my life who are for the system as currently proposed, are yourself and Dr. Richard DeMarco, who's a wonderful fellow, but I would say that that really it's not a popular opinion, and I find it amazing that you support it.
Does Ricky want a peerage as well? Heavens, I never thought that.
Actually, that's one of the very good the best idea I've had for a long time.
It is curious. I suppose that there's something, Richard, to what you say. I was wondering, there are parts, very important parts of the constitution of this country, which depend entirely on accidental processes. And the accident of heredity may be as justifiable as the premium bond or the national lottery.
And it works. I mean, the pure simple fact of the matter is it works, and only class warriors and strict rationalists say because it's irrational, it ought to go. I mean, in which case, of course, we must get rid of Hoddle for having views on whatever he had views on. We must get rid of the church, which is clearly irrational. We must get rid of opera, because it's obviously irrational. I mean, everything that makes life tolerable, valuable, and useful, of course you've got to get rid of, because it's irrational. I mean, it's a balmy way of going on. We know we don't live by rational systems. What we live by is systems that work, that are emotionally rich to us, and produce good, just society. And oddly enough, that is exactly what we've achieved by this extraordinary system called the House of Lords.
This strange quirk, part of the dignified element in the Constitution, I suppose, we have to call it.
No, it's not dignified, it's extremely functional.
Yes.
Oh, come.
I'm reading the House of Lords Select Committee report on genetically modified organisms. You'll never find a better piece.
That is not a representation of the entire House of Lords.
I think we have to bear in mind that if you have committees of the House of Lords which have on them people like Noel Annan or Walter Perry, they're going to be quite well informed and quite judicious.
Yes,
but these are life peers, not people who are there because way back in the family tree there was a certain amount of high placed adultery.
Well, good, but at least you're conceding that we won't have a House of Lords which is drearily representative of the people. We'll have an elitist one full of bright scientists. So you've conceded a good chunk of my principle. And of course these exact people, the life peers, would be many of them the very first in private to say how much they admire the voluntary, unpaid, noble and generous contribution made by the aristocratic peer. It is unfortunate that the aristocrats have given up the ghost and see that they cannot defend themselves. That's why it needs an oit like me to defend them. They're far too well-mannered to defend their rights.
You're right. You're, there again, you leave out your argument. You give us this impression that, in fact, the lady in the big house is constantly touring the villages with a silver salver bearing nourishing soup for the poor.
Well, she's poorer than they are now. But they have to come to her.
What do we know about the Lord Lucans and the Lord Moynihans and the various other dignitaries of the inherited aristocracy who have got up to all sorts of chicanery, from fraud to drug running?
It is one of the great merits of the aristocracy. They provided us with a soap opera. Of course they live highly coloured lives. What's interesting is that the people who understand the aristocracy, and they understand each other very well, are the working class and the aristocracy understand each other, because they're both prey to indebtedness and inebriation. The boring middle classes in the middle find both ends of the society incomprehensible.
So what you're saying is that we should be ruled in this country by, to use your own words, a balmy cast from a soap opera.
Forgive me, I didn't say ruled. I said they should have exactly what they've got now, no more, no less, which is a right to be heard, because we find what they do say turns out to be extraordinarily interesting. Mrs. Thatcher had to admit that, by God, they kept getting things right. And I think we'll find that even poor New Labour will find that the House of Lords is speaking more sense in the long run than they like to admit.
Well, I don't think it's politically very pragmatic to call on Mrs. Thatcher as a source in Scotland, but I hand over to Alistair McIntosh, who I'm quite sure has got something to say.
Let's look at what they've got now, because what concerns me about the Lords is not the relatively minimal amount of power that they have down in Westminster. It's their whole network of public school education, the old boys network, the directorships in the companies, the fact that 20 aristocratic families own 2.5 million acres of Scotland's 19 million acres, and that fully one-third of Scotland's landmass is given over to blood sports as its primary land use. Now, you yourself have said in some of your writings that the Lords can indeed be bloody-minded and therefore unpredictable, but the one predictable thing is that they're into blood sports and so on. Mm. Do you think
that one-third of Scotland's land mass being put over to producing a bit of venison and a few grouse that hardly anybody eats is a good use of our primary resource.
Well, I just thought your difficulty in arguing against it is to work out what better to do with that land, what more, how more sustainably to use it. I mean, the difficulty is it's useless land, and it is, I mean, it'll do a bit of bird and it'll do a bit of deer. You start ploughing it up, and then you have all the greens and the...
No, I have to jump in here. I have to jump in here. I have a small house in Morven on the west coast of Scotland, and that house is surrounded by 400 square miles of ground.
Oh, you're incredibly lucky.
No, wait for it. I own 5 acres, and it's surrounded by 400 square miles in which there is only one resident landowner who owns more than 100 acres. Now, that ground was once the holding ground for the... For the great cattle herds of the Lord of the Isles, and now it's entirely estates and entirely forestry, and the notion that that land could not be used for something else, and then that is a wise use of land, I find a deep obscenity.
Well, whether or not you'd rather have beef than deer. I mean, as to land use terms, I'd have thought a green might say, well, on the whole, actually, the deer. And of course, if you find hunting offensive, that is a great and a growing problem, that people find hunting offensive. And I don't find hunting offensive.
I stalk myself, but I just think it's an appalling use of land.
You have both, I'm afraid, wandered off the point. I can't imagine how this could happen. It's a firmly controlled...
Chairmanship. I always blame the chairman myself.
I will point out that we have a little difficulty here, which is that large chunks of land are, in Scotland, also owned by people who are not remotely aristocratic, but just nouveau riche, perhaps, Parc the New, with a great fat wallet, and they buy it for swank and for killing things. So that is actually a distraction to whether or not the aristocracy...
Precisely. We're actually talking about oligarchy. We're talking about government by the rich. The aristocracy actually slowly recycle themselves. There are none of the barons who originally expounded the Magna Carta still in the House of Lords. None of those who fought at Agincourt are still in the House of Lords. They've gradually died out. But new recruits come in from big new money coming in.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're seeing today.
Wonderful system. It's a wonderful system in which the English aristocracy, unique in Europe, refreshes itself by the whichever current generation of shakers and movers are around, and that's one of the reasons why it is such a brilliantly good aristocracy, which of course is trashed all too carelessly by people who don't think about it.
I am deeply upset at this point, not by Richard, who was there to upset me, obviously, but why we should care toughness about there being none of the barons who were at Runnymede or at Agincourt. There are certainly very few, if any, who were at a more important date in our history and our growth. And there, I am sure, are people in the House of Lords, we all know for a fact there are, who were at some other places. They were at Culloden. Unfortunately, they were on the other side.
Absolutely, absolutely. My point is that what counts is not so much blood lineage as money. And money attaches itself to blood lineage in creating this myth of aristocracy. And this is... It's a deep significance in how a land is used.
If you felt you were impoverished, and it is typical of the aristocracy, rather like farmers, that they are permanently impoverished, no matter what the outside of their appearances may be,
because they're so generous to their people.
If you felt yourself so impoverished, and Consuelo Vanderbilt turned up, wouldn't you say, well, I don't mind the American accent in Blenheim, have you got all that money?
No, I'm sorry, I prefer poverty. And I have in my life chosen poverty instead.
That's why you're appearing here on Radio Scotland. Can I just say, I mean, I think we have made the nicest case for the aristocracy here, which is in their estate management when they're good, and they're mostly good, and God knows there's some bad ones, but on the whole, aristocratic management is much more interested in the long term, both in terms of the quality of the land and the quality of the people on it. So it leaves things alone, doesn't screw it for profit. I fear that when you start trashing the aristocracy and you get who would take over? People with money. They'll sweat the asset. You're very lucky to have aristocrats who, on the whole, say, we like an agreeable way of life. God knows we're broke, but the porridge and the kilt are in place and we're happy enough.
Richard, your argument seems to me to, again, flip the gears there, because surely what you've said is the mere fact to be an aristocrat makes saints of those who once were sinners, and
I think
their grandchildren are.
I think ennoblement has proved largely ennobling. It's a rather interesting quality.
Dukedoms all round. Thank you very much indeed. Alistair McIntosh, Max on the Cloud, and Richard D. North. A great net. Look at